3 weeks and counting, and they're still out there.
I'm right down the middle. I'm afraid in November I'm going to choose the lesser of two evils, is how I look at it. Yeah, I could vote for either one right now.
Undecided voters will be critical to the outcome of the presidential election next month. Will the last and final presidential debate tonight between Barack Obama and John McCain make a difference? We'll take a look. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, October 15th. John Hockenberry is away. We have the latest on the world markets after a week of wild swings. A story about a Republican candidate who's looking to Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama for help. And it's Wash Your Hands Day all over the world. UNICEF is trying a simple way to help save lives. Those stories are coming up, but first, Femi Oke is here with the latest headlines. Femi.
Hello there, Dora. Good morning. The White House has said what it wants to do with the $700 billion. Now it gets to work. President Bush is meeting with his cabinet today to talk about the money that will go into the nation's top banks. Fed Chair Ben Bernanke is giving a speech in New York today. After significant rallies on global markets yesterday, today they're mostly down or flat. Japan's Nikkei closed up just over 1%. Hong Kong's Hang Seng lost nearly 5%. European markets are down about 3%. And even with the global effort to kickstart the financial system, there are still concerns it's not enough to keep a global recession at bay. Both presidential candidates have laid out their economic plans. On the campaign trail in Ohio, Barack Obama kept up his support for the Bush administration's dramatic first step.
I think the idea of injecting capital directly into banks is a good one. It gives taxpayers a better chance of getting their money out.
But John McCain says he's baffled by people having to pay taxes on unemployment benefits.
I'm also proposing today that for those who are between jobs, we eliminate all taxes on unemployment benefits.
The economy will be topic number one when John McCain and Barack Obama debate tonight. The third and final debate is taking place at New York's Hofstra University, and CBS News' Bob Schieffer will moderate. Santa Ana winds have eased off enough to allow firefighters to gain some ground on two big wildfires in the L.A. suburbs. Deputy Fire Chief Mario Rueda says that more than 1,200 evacuated residents won't be allowed back home yet.
I understand what an inconvenience it is, but on the flip side, I don't want to put anybody in harm's way.
Oil fell below $78 a barrel in Asian trading today. The Dow closed down less than 1% yesterday to 93.10. The S&P was also flat, and it's set to open up at 17.79. Adora.
Many thanks, Femi. And as you know, here at The Takeaway, we're conducting America's exit poll.
I made up my mind when McCain chose Palin, who else would he pick for other key positions in our government? Government's not bad. The people you put in government is bad.
What was the exact moment that you decided to vote for one candidate versus the other? Or perhaps you're undecided. Why is that? You're not pleased with the two candidates? Are you not going to vote? Are you waiting for them to say something specific? 8778-MY-TAKE. We want to hear your story.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning on this Wednesday, October 15th. And here with me in the studio to ride through this hour today is Todd Zwillick from Capital News Connection. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, Adora.
Just this morning, Secretary of the Treasury Hank Paulson said that he expects improvement in the condition of the economy over time, but that there will be, quote, a bump in the road along the way. This, a day after Secretary Paulson called each of the nine largest banks' chiefs into a meeting and essentially demanded that they sign on the dotted line on a program to inject cash into the banking system. But it was a meeting that sounds like it was full of drama. Mark Landler, who wrote an article for the New York Times, he's covering the story for the New York Times with Eric Dash, joins us now from Washington. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Adora.
You don't necessarily associate bankers and drama in the same sentence, but it sounds as if this meeting yesterday came as quite a surprise to some of the bankers when Secretary Paulson described his plan. What happened?
Well, essentially, on Sunday, sometime in the late afternoon, Mr. Paulson began calling the CEOs of the nine largest banks individually in person and told them to report to his conference room Monday at 3 p.m., didn't tell them what the subject was, and they spent, I'm sure, a nervous evening trying to figure it out. And by all accounts, none of them figured that they would be asked basically to accept a government investment in their bank and given no choice, and not only that, given less than 3.5 hours to make the decision. So to call it a surprise is probably an understatement.
So they're sitting in this meeting, and the secretary lays out very specific details. Was there screaming and yelling? Was there discomfort? I mean, if they were that shocked, what was the reaction?
Well, from what we understand from talking to a number of people who were in the room, there was a good deal of discomfort. I think I would stop short of saying there was screaming and shouting, but there was a very, very tense exchange between several of the bankers and Mr. Paulson, and some of it focused on and came from the bankers from banks that were quite healthy, that didn't feel they needed government money, that worried having the government as a shareholder, what would that mean for other shareholders, and even made a kind of a cultural point. The chairman of Wells Fargo said, look, I'm based in San Francisco. I've stayed far away from these fancy mortgage-backed securities that you guys on Wall Street got into, and now I'm sitting in a room having to talk about bailing you out. So there was a good deal of hard feeling, but also by all accounts, they came on board pretty fast because the inevitability of it and the lack of any better options was so clear to them.
Outline the plan, the $125 billion plan.
Well, essentially, the government will buy what's called perpetual preferred shares in each of these banks. The size of the investment is roughly equivalent to the size of the assets on the balance sheet. The government will hold those shares for some period of time, presumably a few years. With each investment comes the right for the government to buy warrants equivalent to 15% of the investment. So if they were to invest $100 million into a bank, they'd have the right to buy $15 million worth of warrants, which after a period of years can convert into common stock. Now, that's really important because the issue that shareholders have with government injections of capital is that it dilutes other shareholders. And that's not something that's good for the banks, for the shareholders. Nobody likes it. And the government has structured this in a way to give the banks an incentive to raise capital from other places before that conversion would ever happen. And so essentially they would buy the government out, and the government would only be a non-voting preferred shareholder for the entire time that they were invested in each bank.
So Mark, now that this deal is done, do these nine banks essentially have to start lending now and borrowing? Or if they don't have to under the rules, is there such political and public pressure on them now that they essentially have to start lending, now that they have this money?
I think that's very much the message. I mean, Mr. Paulson said it in the news conference yesterday. He said it in the meeting directly to them. He said, you know, I don't want you to hoard this cash. I want you to deploy it. So the point here, and I think the political pressure will be overwhelming, is that this is how you unlock the credit markets. This is how you get these banks lending to each other. And that's why he was very careful to, number one, give cash to all nine banks and not to distinguish between banks that were a little bit shaky, which several of them are, and then the ones that are healthy. Because his point is, this isn't designed to resuscitate failing banks. It's designed to take healthy banks and persuade them to start lending.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, the rationale of taking a Wells Fargo, which was healthy, but also lots of seven or eight banks that aren't as healthy, lumping them all in together sends the message, you are all in this together. There are no outliers here. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right. And then to look at it from the negative point of view, the big fear they had is, let's say they'd made the program very voluntary, very open-ended, which would be closer to what happened in Britain. They also took in eight of their largest banks into a room and made them essentially the same offer, but it was much more voluntary. In Britain, Barclays, one of the biggest banks, and not actually a bank that's extremely strong, opted not to take the money. And so there is a stigma attached to taking government money. And the fear was if they didn't really make it all but mandatory, a couple of the banks would peel off. There'd be a lot of infighting between them. You know, you took government money, you're a bailout, I'm not. By doing it this way, you remove the stigma. It's part of almost a national effort, if you will.
Mark, let's talk about some of the strings attached. I mean, you really describe an extraordinary scene, which is the secretary and these nine heads of the banks sitting there drinking coffee and drinking Coke and talking about these things. What is the government demanding in return for the money that's being injected into these banks?
Well, there is a school of thought that they're not actually demanding that much. There is a dividend that you have to pay on the preferred stock. It also goes up after 5 years from 5% to 9%. Again, another mechanism to persuade the banks to buy out the government before you get to 5 years. But there's no very stringent control provisions. For example, there's nothing in the agreement that says that the bank needs to call Hank Paulson before they make any kind of an investment. There is, and this is important, there is a fairly strict restriction on executive compensation. An executive who leaves a bank that has government money in it can't get a golden parachute. Any compensation over $500,000 is not tax deductible.
But let me stop you there for a second, because there's essentially a caveat there, isn't there? I mean, you know, the chief of Wells Fargo Bank, apparently, according to some reports, and you talk about this in your story,
mm-hmm.
has potentially tens of millions of dollars that he'll receive when he leaves the bank. This agreement wouldn't touch the package that he's already has in, say, a contract, I would assume.
That's right. And that's why there's a little bit of sort of discussion going on about getting underneath those compensation restrictions and really trying to figure out how strict they are. And some people are arguing they're not actually that strict. If this guy can leave and get hundreds of millions in payout and it's not actually covered by any of these restrictions, well, how tough are they? Mr. Paulson's argument is they're really tough, and in fact he made them even tougher than what Congress passed in the bailout bill. But there are people saying, look, there's ways to get around stuff. And you know, frankly, with the exception of the chairman of Wells Fargo, there wasn't a huge debate about the executive compensation issue during this meeting. It was more focused on other things.
Well, Mark, you mentioned Congress, and I wonder how much certainty these bank CEOs, these nine bank CEOs who had their hands held as they signed on the dotted line, how much certainty do they have about what this deal is going to look like after Congress gets its bite at this apple? You know, Barney Frank is out there, Chris Dodd, they're both out there saying they are coming back to regulate and they want more oversight. You said there's not a lot of oversight on the kinds of transactions the banks might make with this money. So do they have certainty going forward that the game's not going to change?
Well, under the bailout bill that Paulson got through Congress and that Congress passed, it gave him authority in this area. It was in the bill. He's not asking for anything additional. And because the bill was very focused on asset repurchases, it doesn't actually talk in extreme detail about capital injections. Of course, Congress will talk about strengthening oversight, and that is in the original bill. So I think you'd have to say, with the government as a shareholder for the first time in your history, of course you have uncertainty. That said, Mr. Paulson thinks he has fairly broad authority in this area and will probably fight very strongly to retain that authority in how he designs the program going forward.
Mark Landler, it's always a great pleasure. Thank you so much for that report.
Thanks, Adora.
Mark Landler, coming to us from the New York Times in Washington, D.C., covering what's happening at the Treasury Department and the federal bailout plan to inject cash into the banking system. And Todd Zwillix, also here with us from the Capital News Connection.
Uncertain times. We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I decided to vote for Obama when I realized he was calm, intelligent, and thoughtful, something we're not used to with politicians of recent years.
Well, there's a thought on the upcoming presidential election. What was the exact moment you decided for one candidate or the other? Or perhaps you're still undecided. What do you need to hear from the candidates in order to make up your mind? Give us a call at 877-8-MYTAKE or drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And with us, riding along on this hour of The Takeaway, is Todd Zwillick from Capital News Connection. So welcome to New York.
Thank you. You know, Ralph Nader's at the Cooper Union giving a speech before the debate tonight.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So he wants a little bit of attention. He's in New York.
But certainly many eyes are going to be on John McCain tonight, because across the country, some Republican candidates are really feeling threatened by low approval ratings of the Republican President Bush and a tough economy. And in Nebraska, Republican incumbent Lee Terry from the 2nd District has come up with a novel strategy. He's tying his campaign to Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama, who's actually up a bit in the polls. Dave Boomer is on the line from Nebraska. He's the campaign manager for Congressman Lee Terry. Good morning, Dave. And is that right, a Republican tying his fate to a Democrat?
Well, not quite, but good morning to you. The what we're doing in Omaha is it is very interesting. For the first time in years, there's a competitive presidential campaign out here. The Obama campaign has spent millions of dollars to win what essentially is one electoral vote in Nebraska. We divide them up by congressional districts.
Mm-hmm.
And Obama is making a major effort here. They have been registering voters, as we have, frankly, the Republicans. But the upshot is our message is, if you're going to vote for Obama, that's fine. Vote for Lee Terry also. And there are Democrats that will do that.
It just sounds funny, and I'm chuckling, because obviously there are big differences in Republicans and Democrats. I'm looking at an ad that I believe you released to the Omaha Reader, and it says, Obama, Terry voter. Anyone? ? Tell us about it.
Sure. And there's a picture with it. It's a young woman named Melanie. And Melanie is a real person. She works at a coffee shop in Omaha. And I met her several months ago, actually, and as I go in for coffee in the morning. And she told me that she was going to vote for Obama, but she also was going to vote for Lee Terry. And I will admit that's, it struck me as, kind of interesting, but there are many people like her. And here's why. Lee Terry's been the congressman here for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone knows him, and they know that he's a very accessible, hardworking, honest guy. And frankly, that trumps issues on a lot of occasions. He's helped thousands and thousands of people with constituent casework needs. And that is showing up in the form of people and even Democrats saying, Lee, I'm with you.
But Dave, why not just say that in your ads as opposed to linking Lee Terry to Barack Obama?
Well, maybe we'll do that in the next one.
Well, Dave, this is Todd Zwillick. When you look at the electoral map of Nebraska, you mentioned that it's divided up into congressional districts. You can take, Barack Obama can take one electoral vote out of Nebraska if he's lucky. And in that second district, Lee Terry's district, if he does it, is likely to be where he does it in Nebraska. How much of your strategy has to do with that Obama is actually surging in and around Omaha?
Well, let me point out that the last poll that was done was released Friday by a company called Research 2000. They are a respected polling firm. They generally poll for Democrats. And that poll had McCain winning by 13 points.
So, Dave, are you concerned about losing Republican votes with this kind of campaigning?
No, because I think our base is very, very solid, rock solid, actually. And this just gives us the opportunity to go after, kind of open up the playing field a bit, and go after those kind of, I call them the Reagan Democrats. They're Democrats, but they are more to the conservative side. We traditionally have won about one out of five Democrats, Lee Terry has. And that's who we're going after. And also independent voters. About 20% of the district are registered independents. And, you know, again, there are people that are voting for Obama, and they want change, but they're tired of the 8 years of the Republicans in the White House. But there are Democrats who are going to say, but Lee Terry, our congressman, he's a good guy, and I'm supporting him.
And yet Mr. Terry's opponent, Mr. Esch, is making every effort, of course, to tie Lee Terry to George Bush, as a lot of Democratic candidates are throughout the country, and saying Lee Terry voted with George Bush more than 90% of the time. Sounds like a familiar refrain. Is this enough to counteract that charge?
Well, there are many things we do. Just to set the record straight, Lee Terry's independent. He's disagreed with the Bush administration many times on many, many issues. And I don't think that that particular charge has a lot of traction out here. But you're right. That's the mantra of all the Democrat candidates.
Very quick question for you. What's been the reaction of the local Republican Party?
To the advertisement?
Correct.
Well, they understand what we're doing, that they support Lee Terry. He's got a base of support that's almost unanimous among the Republicans. And to cobble together our majority, they know that we need to go after these independent voters and then that share the Democrats who might vote for Lee. And in the past, as I mentioned, we have won one out of five Democrats.
Dave Boomer, thanks for joining us. Dave Boomer is the campaign manager for Congressman Lee Terry, who is in the 2nd District in Nebraska. Now we're turning to Femi Oke, who's got some headlines for us.
Thank you very much. It is 28 minutes past the hour. Wall Street is headed for a mixed open today. Investors may be waiting to hear results of retail sales in September. The Commerce Department is expected to report they were down almost 1%. Iraqi leaders are reviewing a draft agreement that allows U.S. troops to stay in Iraq past the end of the year deadline. Now, according to sources close to negotiations, the draft calls for U.S. troops to return to their bases by next June and be completely out by December 2011. Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper won re-election yesterday, and Mr. Harper was good-humoured about the number of elections his supporters had to put up with.
I want to begin by thanking once again for electing me to Parliament for the fourth time in just 6 years. Four times in 6 years, a big thank you to the voters of Calgary Southwest.
He didn't sound too put out by that. Prime Minister Harper did not win the Conservative majority in Parliament that he was looking for, and he was hurt by criticism for his initial nonchalant response to the financial crisis. And the Man Booker Prize is going to 33-year-old Aravind Adiga. The Australian Indian author won for his debut novel, The White Tiger. That's a look at your news for now.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Here at The Takeaway, we're conducting what we're calling America's Exit Poll, which is we want to hear how you made up your mind or how you haven't made up your mind about which presidential candidate that you plan to vote for come voting day next month. What is it that you need to hear What is it that you did hear? Do you remember when that moment was that you decided you were going to go with one candidate versus the other? We want to hear about that moment at 8778-MYTAKE or at mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Tonight, the presidential candidates, Obama and McCain, will sit down for their third and final debate. Do you think either candidate will change your mind? Atlantic Monthly writer James Fallows joins us with his thoughts, which you can also find in his recent article, Rhetorical Questions, where he examined 3 decades of political debates. He comes to us from Beijing. Good morning, or I should say good evening. How many hours of debates have you watched?
It seemed like 1 zillion, but it probably must have been between 60 and 70. There were more than 40 of these debates. Typically, they were 90 minutes long. I'm talking mainly about the primary debates this year. So it really took a long time to download them and streaming video here to China, but then I watched a lot of them.
And what struck you most in watching them in such a concentrated way?
Well, you know, concentrating this over the years, I once worked in presidential politics. I was Jimmy Carter's speechwriter long ago, back at the dawn of time. And I've been interested in debates since then. I've done stories for The Atlantic for the last couple of presidential cycles. This time, in focusing on the primary debates where we had the cast of thousands, what was interesting is the role that the moderators on cable TV got to play in sort of steering things in ways that made the politicians more or less like soap opera performers. But I guess the central truth about debates, which applies whether we're talking about the primaries or the ones, you know, starting back with Kennedy and Nixon, is yes, these are political theater, but in a good sense. The reason we watch them is it's the only opportunity to see candidates face to face. We can size them up against each other and see how they carry themselves and hold themselves and respond. And that usually ends up being what matters and has some kind of lasting political influence from the debates.
And you also talk about the role of the moderator. You just mentioned that. Let's listen to a clip of Wolf Blitzer from CNN.
I just want everybody to raise their hand and tell me if you agree that if the U.S. had intelligence that could take out Osama bin Laden and kill him, even though some innocent civilians would die in the process, would you, as president, authorize such an operation? If you would, raise your hand.
It would depend on how many innocent civilians.
Yeah, I mean, part of this is one of these hypotheticals, Wolf, that is very difficult to answer in the abstract.
Now, that would be from the Democratic candidate debate that was moderated by Wolf Blitzer. And what's your thought on that interaction?
What was interesting about that debate is that was probably 8 or 10 debates into the Democratic primary cycle this year. And by then, the Democrats had sort of gotten their back up about these raise-your-hand questions or yes-no questions or will-you-pledge-today questions or answer-in-10-seconds questions that had been featured by many of the moderators before that. When those questions were first introduced in the very initial Democratic debate back in April of last year by Brian Williams of NBC, people sort of meekly complied. Yes, I'll raise my hand if I have a gun. No, I won't put my hand up if I disagree with the global war on terror. But it shows the way in which it shows the bad side of debates, where they're made to have the candidates perform stunts on the issues. I think we're seeing, sometimes tedious as it is, the better side during the last couple we've seen between McCain and Obama, the one that'll happen in 12 hours or so, because they talk about the questions have to be more substantive, and it's mainly, as I was saying earlier, the carriage of the candidates, the way they respond to follow-ups that seems to be what we judge them on.
Well, James Fallows, this is Todd Zwillick from Capital News Connection. I'm curious, because as we look at tonight's debate, and everybody throws that word game changer around for John McCain since he's behind in the polls. Can you get a game changer out of a debate? Is there such a thing as winning for him, or is there only an opportunity to make mistakes?
I think they're interesting and separable questions. Certainly there are such things as game changers through the long history of debates. There are some academic studies, which I will acknowledge, which argue that actually you can't find a huge statistical variance in election results based on debates. But certainly it seems, looking at the history of things, there are ways in which the performance in debates either usually makes some difference in confirming what people already suspected, good or bad, about a presidential candidate. And I think think the litany I would give is that in 1960, John Kennedy went up against Richard Nixon. The question was, is Kennedy this young kid? Is he prepared to stand up with Nixon? And Kennedy carried himself in a way that seemed to get him through that hurdle. Same with Reagan and the incumbent Jimmy Carter in 1980. Same with Bill Clinton and the incumbent senior George Bush in 1992. And I would argue the same for Barack Obama in the first two debates. He made himself seem plausible, just, you know, able to stand with a more familiar character. I think at this stage, with a final debate with less than 3 weeks to go for the election and apparently large lead, something really cataclysmic would have to happen on the debate stage or someplace else to make for Senator McCain to feel as if he'd had, you know, a real different, you know, effect. Barack Obama would have to say, you know, William Ayers is the father of my love child baby or something like that.
James, don't put any ideas on the table. Don't put it just very quickly, though, because sometimes there are 10 or 20 seconds that really are memorable to voters. Let's listen to Carter and Reagan in 1980.
These are the kind of elements of a national health insurance important to the American people. Governor Reagan, again, typically is against such a proposal.
Governor, there you go again.
Was that a game changer, quickly, James?
It does seem to be that in retrospect, just as I would argue Senator McCain this time not looking at Barack Obama in the first debate and calling him that one in the second debate crystallized something, an impression that's hard for McCain to deal with.
James Fallows, such a great pleasure. James Fallows is the national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly, and you can check out his latest article called Rhetorical Questions. Now we turn to Femi Oke, who's got the latest headlines for us.
Thank you very much, Adoa. The time is just coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. The second highest ranking leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq is dead after a military operation in the northern city of Mosul. The U.S. military says he had ties to senior leaders in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Retail sales dropped 1.2% in September, and that's according to the Commerce Department, and that's the biggest decline in 2 years. Wholesale prices also fell for the second straight month. President Bush is meeting with his cabinet today to discuss specifics of distributing $250 billion to nine major banks. And one of those nine, the Bank of New York Mellon, has been hired by the Treasury Department to act as a gatekeeper of the funds. The bank will keep accounting records and serve as auction manager and sell $3 billion worth of stock to the government. A new report from the Washington Post finds the Bush administration endorsed the use of waterboarding against Al-Qaeda suspects. The White House issued two previously classified memos to the CIA in 2003 and 2004, and that's the administration's first consent for the use of such aggressive interrogation techniques. Leaders from Russia and Georgia are meeting in Geneva today for the first time since the war over South Ossetia this summer. The UN and EU organizers threw a news blackout over the politically charged one-day talks. And finally, for youngsters who don't like the taste of anti-malaria tablets, there are going to be new cherry flavors which will help encourage them to take their medicine. And that's a look at your news for now.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji. We're going to take a look at something that most of us take for granted that can actually save millions of lives every year, and that's hand washing. Today, 120 million children across Asia are taking a couple of minutes of their time to wash their hands. It's the highlight of a campaign organized by the UN's children agency, UNICEF, to promote what is one of the world's most cost-effective forms of preventative health care. We're joined from Delhi, India, by Sarah Crowe, who is the South Asia spokeswoman for UNICEF. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you very much. Good day.
So, describe Global Handwashing Day.
Well, it's as you say, it's quite an historic moment today because millions and millions of South Asian children, right from Kabul to Karachi, Kathmandu to Kerala, and Delhi to Dhaka in Bangladesh, have been washing their hands and learning the power of proper sanitation through soap suds, and really also pledging not to what we call openly defecate. This South Asian region has one of the highest numbers of people not having access to a proper toilet. So this is a very ordinary act, and today these millions of children across the region are making this ordinary act quite extraordinary by taking part in the very first Global Hand Washing Day.
And how are you providing the resources for this day to take place if you're saying that many of these children don't have access to bathrooms or to soap or to other ways or to other things that would help them keep their hands clean?
Interestingly enough, what typically happens in a very poor village across South Asia is that there is some form of soap, but it often is not used to wash hands. People use this kind of soap from animal fat, from ash, from various forms of herbs and local plants to clean their own clothes, to clean their homes, to clean their pots and pans, etc. But it's often not seen as being useful for hand washing. So like any bad habit, it's bad, it's not easy to break. We know that it is, as you said earlier, one of the most cost-effective ways of stopping the disease, the spread of diseases such as diarrhea and pneumonia, and these diseases are the biggest killers of children in South Asia. So this one act and getting access to the kind of soap that exists naturally around community, and of course just encouraging families to use proper soap, and children in particular, because we at UNICEF recognize that children are very powerful agents of change in their own communities. What they learn in the playground, what they learn in their own communities, they take home, and they become little ambassadors, as it were, for this new form of sanitation for them. What often happens with children is they see their hands look clean, and so therefore they think their hands are clean without realizing that it's what cannot be seen that is so dangerous some of the time.
And clearly that's something that we certainly take for granted here in the U.S. in washing our hands, given the kinds of campaigns and the ways that children learn that here. Sarah Crow, thank you so much for joining us. Sarah Crow is the South Asia spokesperson for UNICEF, describing Global Hand Washing Day.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, October 15th. Femi Oke has just joined us. She's got the latest headlines of the hour.
Good morning. It is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Markets in Asia slipped slightly today after massive gains in the last 2 days. In Europe, the FTSE is down about 4%. Oil prices are down to around about $78 a barrel. Financial troubles will be the main topic at a meeting of 27 European Union leaders at a summit today in Brussels. French President Nicolas Sarkozy will push for acceptance of a plan to help out troubled banks. And most European leaders agreed to go along with that plan earlier this week. The US presidential candidates will have their last chance to debate in tonight's meeting at Hofstra University on Long Island, and the meeting will focus on domestic policy. And this political season is going to be remembered for the political ads. There have been the attack ads.
Barack Obama and domestic terrorist Bill Ayers, friends. They've worked together for years, but Obama tries to hide it. Why?
And then there have been the ads that have a little bit more in the way of humour in them. MoveOn.org has an ironic take on the adverts aimed at parents telling their kids not to do drugs. But this time, it's the kids doing the warning.
Are you thinking about voting for John McCain?
Just because other people your age are doing it doesn't make it cool.
You say it's harmless. It's just one vote.
Voting Republican even once
can have disastrous effects that last for years.
You're not only risking your future, you're risking mine.
Mom, talk to your parents about John McCain.
It's worth a look. It's an ironic take on don't do drugs. And of course, tonight again, just a reminder, the final U.S. presidential debate happens at the University of Hofstra on Long Island, and it will be chaired by CBS's Bob Schieffer. That's a look at your news for now.
Thanks very much, Femi. And we'll actually be Twittering Brian Lehr, Andrea Bernstein, our political director, among others, will be Twittering tonight. And still with us today is Todd Zwillick from the Capital News Connection. And we're going to continue to talk about politics in your honor, since you came from Washington, D.C.
Thank you. I think when you Twitter, it's called tweeting, isn't it?
Is it tweeting?
You tweet. You tweet on Twitter, and I think
it's not actually. I guess I'm using it more generically, like Xerox is a copy machine.
Yeah,
we're going to be. I'm splitting hairs. We're splitting hairs. I've been told by the control room now to move on. Thanks very much, Todd.
Okay, fair enough.
We're talking about the presidential debate, the last and final one that will be taking place tonight. While John McCain is preparing to debate with Barack Obama tonight, Sarah Palin has been in Pennsylvania.
There is only one man in this campaign who has ever really fought for you, and he is the man with courage to keep on fighting for you.
That's Governor Palin campaigning in Pennsylvania. Though recent polls in the state show Obama with a double-digit lead over McCain, still, the McCain campaign's not giving up. Yesterday, Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein went to Pennsylvania herself. She was in Scranton yesterday covering Palin's event just a couple of days after she was there when Hillary Clinton was stumping on behalf of Barack Obama. Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning. And it was in the very same locale in Scranton, but completely different scene. The sort of room was darkened before Palin came in. Everybody was told to wear red. There were sort of searchlights sweeping the crowd, and people were holding signs that said, "Hard coal country for McCain." I mean, this is a former coal region in Pennsylvania. Catholic women for Sarah, military families for McCain, and my favorite, Pennsylvania clings to Sarah. And boy, did they. I mean, they just loved Sarah Palin. And she had this logic of her argument. I mean, when she walked in and to the sports arena and said, you know, "Hello, hockey moms," it sort of seemed to make more sense than it did coming from, you know, a big debate stage in St. Louis. And the crowd just ate her up, especially when she started talking about resource recovery.
Our plan for clean coal is going to create over 30,000 new jobs where they're needed most. Places like Ohio and West Virginia and right here in Pennsylvania. And we will safely drill for the billions of barrels of oil that we have underground. And that means safely tapping into our oil resources offshore. We will drill here and we'll drill now. Yeah.
So clearly these are hardcore fans that came out to see Sarah Palin. What is it about her that they like so much?
Well, I was talking to some of the voters beforehand, and I should say that after everyone started chanting "drill, baby, drill," then she started chanting "drill, baby, drill." Then she said "mine, baby, mine." So she is really speaking sort of directly into the heart of this area. And, you know, Scranton, as I mentioned, is this old coal town sort of nestled in the foothills of the Poconos.
And home of Joe Biden.
And home of Joe Biden.
And raised in
Scranton. And Hillary
Scranton.
Clinton's grandfather.
Everybody claims Scranton.
Right.
It's like Peoria. Everybody
if you drive
claims it.
Out into the almost any of these country roads, you will see rod and gun clubs everywhere. And it's a very, very pro-life crowd. One of the women I spoke to before the speech, Janine Blodnicker, was there with her daughter and her granddaughter, and she pretty much summed it up.
Like her stand on pro-life? Absolutely. Like her stand on guns? Should be able to have them. Mostly pro-life, but I like what she did in Alaska. I think she'd be great for this country.
Well, Andrea, I have a question. Who's connecting better in and around Scranton and eastern Pennsylvania? I mean, it's amazing that Joe Biden has said the word Scranton in this campaign far more than he said certainly Delaware or almost any other word. He says Scranton, Scranton, I'm from Scranton. Oh, by the way, did I mention Scranton? Yeah. And here comes Sarah Palin. She electrified the crowd. Did you have a sense of who's doing a better job of electrifying Scranton?
Well, at the event that I was at on Sunday, I mean, it was Sunday, and this event was on, what was yesterday? Tuesday in the afternoon. So, I mean, it's a different time, but the Sunday event was probably five or six times as many people. Now, Joe Biden was there, and Hillary Clinton, and Bill Clinton. So, it was a really big crowd, and people were, you know, felt very excited to be there. They were riled up by Hillary. There's this deep affection for Hillary, but there was this event with Sarah Palin. I mean, it had sort of a religious feeling about it. I mean, afterwards, people, you know, looked like they'd been infused with this religious spirit. People were glowing. And I have a little clip here of people on the rope line. I mean, the rope line was probably about 15 people deep, and people were throwing their T-shirts at Sarah Palin and saying, Sarah, Sarah, you know, give me your photo, sign this picture of my house. Here's a little bit of what that feels like, plus a couple of the women that were on the rope line.
Sarah! God, you have a wonderful life! Thank you!
You're a Sarah Palin fan?
I am. She's so pro-life. I'm very pro-life, and I think she's just fantastic. She was sent from heaven.
What is it that you liked about her speech?
I just love her.
So they're really drawn in, and she clearly is speaking very strongly to them. But is this the base, or is this a combination of independent voters?
It is the base. It's absolutely the base. And everybody that I spoke to had actually already decided to vote for McCain before he picked her. You might remember that yesterday when I was in Philadelphia, I spoke to some voters there, and one of the kinder words for Sarah Palin was, she's a nitwit. I mean, you know, she's been very polarizing, and that was actually from somebody who had been thinking about McCain but decided to go Obama when he chose Sarah Palin. Out in the square in Scranton, you know, we also got some, you know, all kinds of comments about her ability, her intelligence. Here's Charlie, a professor at Scranton University.
She's definitely not spending her evenings at the university splitting atoms.
Is that where you spend your evenings?
Yes.
So he was the original rocket scientist, huh?
Yeah, he was. And, you know, but, you know, what people are also hearing sort of this whole kind of terrorist thing and making these associations with Obama. Here's a retired Busher, and this is what he said to me in the square.
Well, the thing she's saying, it's not true.
What, like what?
About Barack Obama's a Muslim and he's going to raise the taxes.
Do you hear Sarah Palin saying that Barack Obama is a Muslim? Have you heard her say that?
Sure.
You have?
Yes.
I've heard her say he's friends with domestic terrorists.
Well, I don't believe that either.
So she's become the lightning rod. Now, I haven't heard her call Obama a Muslim, but what she has said about terrorists is sort of filtering down to voters this way. This man is a Barack Obama supporter, and he is resenting her for that.
Andrea Bernstein, thank you as always, our political director, talking about the Palin rally in Scranton, Pennsylvania yesterday. And Andrea will be traveling all over the country in the battleground states as we get closer to Election Day. Want to remind you, we're always on at The Takeaway, and we're conducting America's exit poll.
Hi, this is Jim from Astoria. John Paul Stevens is 88 years old. I don't think he's going to be on the Supreme Court come 2012, and I decided a long time ago I didn't want John McCain picking his successor. That's why I'm voting for Obama.
That's interesting. I thought about the Supreme Court, which has not been discussed much on the campaign trail. When did you decide, if you've decided? If not, what's stopping you? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Tonight is the final presidential debate, and we're live blogging. Join us and Andrea Bernstein tonight starting at 8 p.m. Eastern. You'll be able to comment live along with us. I want to thank Todd Zwillick from Capital News Connection for being with us.
It was a pleasure to be here.
I'm Adora Udoji, and it's The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
This is how deals get done in Hollywood, according to The Godfather.
I want you to rest well, and a month from now, this Hollywood big shot's gonna give you what you want.
Too late. They start shooting in a week.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
In Washington, Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson isn't making movies. He's trying to save the markets, and he's made an offer to the 9 biggest banks they can't refuse, or at least he can't let them refuse. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, October 15th. John Hockenberry is away. We'll have details about yesterday's meeting with the Treasury Secretary, the Fed Chair, and the heads of the country's largest bank. It was dramatic, and we have the details. Also, an update on the California wildfires, and goat meat might be the next big thing. You ever tried that? Those stories are coming up, but first, Femi Okay is with us with the headlines. Good morning, Femi.
Good morning. Goat meat is delicious, and the rest of the news, the White House has laid out its plans for the $700 billion bailout, but there's still a lot of explaining to do. President Bush meets with his cabinet today to talk over the details. Fed Chair Ben Bernanke is speaking in New York, and Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson was making the rounds on the morning TV shows. Here he is on Good Morning America.
As the facts have changed and as the situation became more serious, there is no doubt that the best way to get the maximum bang for the taxpayers' buck here was to invest in shares of banks and to increase capital that way.
The plan hasn't eased fears of a global recession. Most Asian markets closed down. European markets are down more than 3%, and the Dow futures are down more than 200 points. And that's even before news of last month's retail sales were released, and they fell sharply for the third month in a row. And they were down 1.2%, nearly double what had been expected. Auto sales were hit the hardest. The economy will be topic number one when John McCain and Barack Obama face off for their third and final debate tonight. It's at Hofstra University in New York, and CBS's news Bob Schieffer will moderate. Los Angeles area firefighters caught a break yesterday. The Santa Ana winds eased off enough to help them gain some ground on two big suburban wildfires. But still, the local fire official, Mario Rueda, says that more than 1,200 evacuated residents can't go home yet.
I understand what an inconvenience it is, but on the flip side, I don't want to be put anybody in harm's way.
And so far, three major fires have burned 34 square miles of Southern California. And oil is just below $78 a barrel in Asian trading today. The Dow closed down less than 1% yesterday to 93.10. The S&P was also flat, and it's set to open at 17.79 a door.
Thanks very much, Femi. And today we're asking you about our America's exit poll. Have you made up your mind about which candidate? What was it about that candidate? What did they say? What did they do? Do you recall exactly where you were when you decided? Or perhaps you're still undecided. What would you like to know from the candidates that might help you make up your mind? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. We want to hear your story, America's exit poll.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
As the facts have changed and as the situation became more serious, there is no doubt that the best way to get the maximum bang for the taxpayers' buck here was to invest in shares of banks and to increase capital that way.
That was Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson speaking this morning, trying to provide some confidence in the latest moves by the Treasury, which is to inject $250 billion into the banking system, hoping to unlock a credit freeze that is concerning governments from the United States all over the world. Joining me in the studio today is Todd Zwillick from Capital News Connection. And clearly, the economy, the turmoil that we're in, and I just should mention that the Hong Kong markets closed at down nearly 5%. The FTSE is down 4.5%. France and Germany also down this morning, and Dow futures down about 200 points, and the markets open in about 25 minutes. All eyes on these markets as officials try to deal with this economic crisis. At the same time, politicians are running for office in Congress, both in the House and Senate, and of course we have a presidential election. What are the members of the House facing, particularly Republicans, in this economic turmoil?
Well, strategists around the country, especially for Republicans, say that this economic turmoil could not have come at a worse time. Republicans traditionally in political races never like economic turmoil. People tend to turn to Democratic candidates in times like that. But this economic turmoil happened a couple of months before election time, even a couple of weeks. The bailout happened a couple of weeks before the election. If you're a Republican, especially a competitive Republican, the timing almost can't be worse.
Because now, given what's taking place, which is major government intervention, it basically is running smack into some of the basic principles of the Republican Party, right, which is a free market.
There's ideological problems with it. There are certainly pocketbook problems with it. People are feeling – this is not theoretical for a lot of people. They are feeling the economic crisis at home. Combine that with a president with a 24% popularity rating, a Congress with a very low popularity rating, and it all spells – normally it would spell trouble for any incumbents at all. And the Democrats are in charge of Congress, but they've only been in charge for 2 years. This is really, fair or not, about George W. Bush and 8 years of that presidency, and I think that's how a lot of people perceive it. It's certainly how a lot of strategists perceive it.
And this struggle with understanding, A, the crisis, and B, what the government needs to do or what's believed needs to be done, let's listen to Michigan Republican Congressman Thaddeus McCotter trying to deal with these issues.
On my part, I consider this an abject betrayal of American taxpayers and our free market system. Let me put this in simplistic terms for people like me to understand. Not the Wall Street, Washington crony capitalists have put a $700 billion bag of dung on taxpayers' doorsteps, rung the bell, and expect you to thank them when you answer it.
That's Thaddeus McCotter, congressman, speaking on Fox News late in September, and he was describing his reaction to the bailout plan that initially was $700 billion. But some estimates today, given the Treasury Department's move forward in supporting the banking system, send it up to about $2 trillion. Yeah.
And he's described it in only a way that Thaddeus McCotter can. He's one of the most colorful and eloquent speakers in the House. He has a way of putting things and he says simple people like me. He's far from simple. He knows how to make himself sound simple. It's quite brilliant. Well, McCotter's an interesting case. He's a conservative Republican in a conservative district. He doesn't have trouble here. He's got a strong ideological position. His district agrees with him. They're against the bailout. He's in a safe seat. He doesn't have any problem with it. Now, a lot of other Republicans and even some Democrats, they might have a dicey time. It really depends if you're in a competitive race or not and how strong you've been ideologically. A Republican who's been a very strong ideological small government well, there's really no such thing as – I guess everybody's anti-socialist.
I was gonna say, where's that? Right. Yeah, small government these days. Where is that?
Where is it? But so then the question is, well, you voted for this. How can you be strong government? Well, what kind of district are they in? If they're in a safe Republican district, it's not really a problem. If they're in a competitive district, the Democratic candidate is unlikely to criticize them for betraying their small government principles because the Democrat is not likely to be that kind of small government ideologue themselves. So I've looked at a lot of the ads. I haven't looked at – all of them certainly, but I'm not seeing a lot of attacks going on this bailout vote or this betrayal of your principles thing. Economy, capital E, no question about it, the number one issue. That along with George W. Bush.
But let's put this into context because you really make an important point, which is the majority of Republicans in the House and in the Senate, those who are up for re-election, clearly everyone in the House, but not every senator, but those who are, most of them are going to be fine, but there is a pocket of potential races that Republicans may lose, and that number seems to grow weekly.
Right. Well, there are 199 Republicans in the House. That's the total. And you're right. A couple of weeks ago, there was thought to be between 15 and 25 that were competitive or in trouble. Numbers grown to 35, edging up on 40. There were some previously safe Republicans, a guy named John Shadegg in Arizona, John McCain's home state, Lee Terry from Nebraska, who we've been talking about, Phil English, who's from Erie, Pennsylvania. These were safe Republicans.
And even senators, Elizabeth Dole.
Is in trouble. Yeah.
And John Sununu in New Hampshire. Elizabeth Dole is in North Carolina, yeah. And John Sununu is in New Hampshire.
The Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, isn't expected to lose, but he's been fighting a hard race. He's the Republican leader of the Senate from Kentucky, a strong conservative in a conservative state, and he's had to fight hard to keep his seat.
You know, let's listen to how this whole discussion obviously has impacted greatly the presidential race. Here's a vice presidential candidate, Sarah Palin.
They look to the past because they want you to think that they're running against the current president and the current administration, but that strategy is starting to wear pretty doggone thin.
That's Governor Palin, who is a Republican, and she is John McCain's running mate. But this hasn't necessarily been a really strong argument that seems to have stuck with many voters. And you had a thought on why that is.
Well, I don't think there's any evidence that the strategy of running against George W. Bush is starting to wear thin. It's probably running thin with a lot of Republicans who are frustrated by it. But this is the reality of politics, and any president with an approval rating below 30%, which is quite remarkable in and of itself, is going to be the topic of the next election. There's no way around it. Now, John McCain tries very hard and has some very good points to make that he hasn't always agreed with the president. In fact, he's opposed him on a lot of key issues. But to expect that argument to wear thin when the American electorate has made it clear how frustrated they are with this White House, it's just not a strategy that they're going to abandon. And there's no evidence that it's wearing thin. In fact, there's quite a lot of evidence that it's working.
A couple of weeks ago, when they were debating this bailout rescue plan, whatever you want to call it, on Capitol Hill, there was a lot of talk about whether or not some Republicans and even some Democrats might suffer for voting for the plan. But there seems to be in polls this acceptance now by the general population that although they're very angry about the government intervention, there is this growing feeling among the majority that something needed to be done before the economy got worse. Do you think that's played into the strategies of those who are running?
Well, part of the shock is probably wearing off. That $700 billion, oh my God, it hit people like a sledgehammer, as it should have. And voters were 9-1, more than 9-1 against it. That seems to have shrunk a little bit. Now you ask voters, there's no hard numbers on this, but maybe 6 out of 10 against it. I mean, nobody's for it, but it's really going to depend, Adora, on whether or not this is perceived to have worked by Election Day. Now, we won't know for sure. I'm talking about perceptions. We'll know in years if this has worked. But if things get a little more stable between now and Election Day, probably no one who voted for this will suffer for it. If they turn horribly, horribly wrong and the bailout is deemed a failure and there's evidence that it's a failure, people who voted for it will really, really wish they hadn't.
What's your take on the presidential debate tonight?
Well,
is it important? Does it really matter? Do you think it's going to change any minds?
It's important for John McCain because he's running out of options. I don't think there's any question about that. Now, whether or not debates change a lot of minds, I'm not an expert in that, but certainly a lot of people will be watching. And John McCain, the clock is ticking. For Barack Obama, whoever thought that he would use a Bushian phrase, stay the course, but his poll numbers are strong. He hasn't made any major mistakes in this campaign. He wants to stay the course tonight.
Todd Zwillick, you're going to hang around. You're going to ride with us this hour.
Yes,
thanks
I will.
For being with us. Todd
of course.
Zwillick, Capital News Connection. And we're asking you about your vote. How did you make up your mind?
Hey, my name is Ray. I'm calling from Northbridge, Mass. I was truly undecided. And one thing that did it for me was the composure of the two. I'm a registered independent, and after watching how Barack Obama handled the economic situation with a calm, cool, collective personality, I've decided to vote for him.
What's your thought? Have you made up your mind? What did it for you? Where were you? When did you make up your mind? Or are you still undecided? What haven't you heard from the candidates that's going to help you make a decision? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Here at The Takeaway, we're conducting what we like to call America's Exit Poll.
Yes, this is Chris from Massachusetts, and I'm undecided. There's something that bothers me. I feel there's really been an undercurrent to make Palin and McCain look really stupid, which turns me away from Obama.
People are already voting in this election. Have you voted? What made up your mind for you? Which candidate did you choose? What are some of the issues that you're thinking about if you are undecided, as that caller was? We really want to hear your stories. We want snapshots of people making decisions as we head towards Election Day. Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We like snapshots, but William G. Jacoby is a professor of political science at Michigan State University and a research scientist at the University of Michigan, where he looks at voters and how they make their decisions from a much more clinical perspective. He is also the co-author of a major study of electoral behavior in the United States called The American Voter Revisited, which came out earlier this year. He's on the line from Michigan. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Now, you call yourself a specialist on what voters think. Describe that, and what have you determined? Is it the issues? Is it the personalities of the candidates? How do people make up their minds?
Well, the major factor that we found in our work, and many, many other political scientists have confirmed as well, is partisanship. It is, for most people, the sense of personal attachment to one of the other parties that really sets in motion the decision-making process that leads to the decision that they make when they enter into the voting booth.
So is it just a question of tradition? Do our parents kind of stick it in our DNA? Is it some genetic component?
Well, believe it or not, there are some political scientists who now claim there is a genetic predisposition to partisanship. That's very new research, and I'm personally not sure how I feel about it at this point. But I'm comfortable saying it's a more mundane process where parents start it off. They transmit their partisan affiliations to their children. Most of us learn that we're either Republicans or Democrats very, very early on, really before we know much what that means. But then the interesting thing about partisanship is that for most of us, this feeling of attachment to a party continues pretty much unabated, and I won't say unchanged, but it's relatively stable for the rest of our lives, for most of us.
Professor, I'd like to bring in Todd Zwillick, who's with us today, riding along from the Capital News Connection. Todd.
Hi, Professor. As partisan as people are, and as your research shows it is, are there as many undecided voters as we think? I mean, in every election, 8%, 10%, 15% undecided. Are those people really undecided, or are they billing themselves as undecided?
I think the latter. There are people who, even if they truly believe they are personally undecided, the psychological mix is already set in their minds. You know, humans, social psychologists tell us pretty clearly that humans are not very good judges of their own decision-making processes. So I think I'm comfortable in saying that in most presidential election campaigns, by the time the general election campaign begins, there are really very few undecided voters. The citizens who do remain undecided, many of them won't vote.
Well, describe that mechanism for us, because clearly if you're paying attention to the trends of polls, it would seem that over a period of time, people do change their mind, whether it be from undecided to a particular party. I mean, let's apply it now. Barack Obama now has a greater lead in the polls against John McCain than he did 6 months ago.
Absolutely. Well, I think what a political scientist would say is that there's a difference between poll results and then what actually happens when people go into the voting booth. I'm very hesitant to place a lot of serious academic weight on pre-election polls, because the way people respond to questions about how they're going to vote are influenced by what's going going on currently, the latest things the candidates have said, and so on. And so from a statistical perspective, there's a lot of noise in those responses. So that's why we see these big fluctuations around there, when in fact I think a lot of political scientists believe they can predict the vote months before the election.
So what do political operatives, the really talented ones, know about so-called undecideds or lack thereof, or people who change their minds, that the rest of us don't? Because Karl Rove is famous for saying to reporters, well, you may have the poll, you may have your numbers, but I have the numbers. I know what's going on with the electorate. What does he know that the rest of us don't?
Well, I think a lot of that is PR. I think a lot of that is blowing fluff, actually. I don't think they know much more. I think the political operatives we hear about in many cases are lucky over time. Karl Rove is probably an exception. Now, what's interesting about Karl Rove, I don't know him personally, but I do know some political scientists who do, and apparently he pays a great deal of attention to the scholarly political science literature and is much more attentive to this very theory that guided our book, this notion that partisanship starts it, and then things that happen subsequently don't have quite as much impact. So I think that's what really they're coming from, the successful ones.
And when you hear so much talk about it's all come down to the independents and the undecided voters, what does that say to you about what's happening in this campaign?
There are a couple of things going on there. I think when it comes down to the independent voters, there does remain a small percentage of independent citizens who will eventually turn out to vote. And of course, as we know, a lot of American elections are decided by very, very small margins. So in those cases, even though I could tell you that I can predict how the majority of the electorate votes, there's still that percentage that makes the difference there. I think, to be honest, I think this campaign is set at this point. I mean, we heard new poll figures this morning, and while I don't really trust any particular poll, the trend
right.
is very clear, and I don't think much is going to change between now and then, unless some external event
mm-hmm.
occurs.
Professor Jacoby, thanks so much for joining us, and I'd like to add, you're a very smart man to be at both Michigan State University and the University of Michigan.
Causes me
thanks.
Trouble during sports season.
I'm sure. William Jacoby is a professor of political science at Michigan State University and a research scientist at the University of Michigan. He is the co-author of a major study of electoral behavior, The American Voter Revisited. And now we go to Femi Okeh, who's an expert on the latest headlines.
Thanks so much, Adore. 28 minutes past the hour. Futures are mixed, with the market set to open in about 2 minutes' time. In Europe, all the major indices are down around about 4%. The second highest ranking leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq is dead after a military operation in the northern city of Mosul. The US military says he had ties to senior leaders in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Meanwhile, a new report from the Washington Post finds the Bush administration endorsed the use of waterboarding against Al-Qaeda suspects. The White House issued two previously classified memos to the CIA in 2003 and 2004. And that's the administration's first consent for the use of such aggressive interrogation techniques. Iraqi leaders are reviewing a draft agreement that allows U.S. troops to stay in Iraq past the end of the year deadline. According to sources close to the negotiations, the draft calls for the U.S. troops to return to their bases by next June and be completely out by December 2011. And that's a look at your news for now.
Thanks very much, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning on this Wednesday, October 15th. We're going to switch gears. Todd Zwillick from Capital News Connection is in the studio with us today, riding through the show. And Todd, I have kind of a personal question. Have you ever had any experience with goat meat?
Goat meat may have saved my life. at
one point. Explain
this. Okay, I'm overstating it. But I was traveling in Mali many years ago on a train in the bush of Western Mali, and I was in a train car with several very surly and angry-looking Malian soldiers. They didn't like my presence there one bit. We pulled up to a village, and I ran out to get some food, and there was a guy grilling goat meat on a 50-gallon drum cut in half with briquettes in it. And I bought a side of goat ribs, a whole side of them. They looked great, and they cost a few pennies. And I brought them on the train, and I brought it wrapped in paper, and I put them in the middle of the train car and passed them around and shared a bunch of goat ribs with some surly soldiers. And they weren't surly for long because the goat meat softened them right up, and we all got along great after that.
Goat meat softened them right up. Well, there's a movement here in the United States where there are some folks hoping that goat meat will be softening up the American palates, particularly foodies. Among them is Bill Nyman. He's a legend in the food world for founding the Nyman Ranch in the 70s using humane methods. Kim Severson from the New York Times has been writing about what he's doing and this growing movement among many to look to goat meat as the new next best thing. And you write about that today in the New York Times.
Right. We in the dining section of the New York Times are predicting goat meat will be the new darling of high-end chefs on both coasts. So we just want to be the first ones to let you know you can go get your goat on pretty soon.
Go get your goat on. So what was it that made Bill Nyman decide he was going to turn to goat meat?
Well, he ran this big company, a company that grew into be, a big company. It's about $85 million worth of sales a year, and he walked away from it a year ago. He had brought in some new managers. It was one of his classic founder's tales. He left the company, sort of licked his wounds for a while, and decided he wanted to get into doing just the very best of a couple different categories of meat. He started his business with cattle, so he went back to cattle, and then he found out that goats and cattle live really well together on a pasture. The goats won't eat what the cattle like, which is clover and other kinds of grass, and the goats will eat all kinds of things like poison oak and stuff that you don't want in your pasture. And then he realized that this goat meat was pretty delicious and that chefs are, you know, always looking for something new. They've been through lamb, they've been through the grass-fed beef, so he's thought goat would be the next thing, and he brought some of this lovely goat around to some chefs who fell in love with it, including some here in New York and San Francisco.
Is Nyman hoping to sell the same kind of bushy, gamey, delicious goat meat that I ate in Western Africa, or is he trying to sell something a little different?
No, this is quite a bit different than the goat meat you might taste at a Pakistani curry house or a jerk cart out in Brooklyn. This is it's a lovely, delicate meat. It's got less fat than chicken, less saturated fat. It's like lamb, but it's got a lot more personality, but kind of personality in a good way. It doesn't have that kind of hoofy, billy goaty thing that comes to mind when you conjure up goat. It's a very different kind of meat. It's delicious.
And there's certainly some stigma, I would assume, that they're going to have to get over. The idea of kind of eating goat isn't something that is generally seen or done here in the U.S. I mean, my dad's Nigerian, and they eat a lot of goat, so mm-hmm. It's a very common meat in those foods. But here, less so. How do you invite people to start eating goats?
Right. I guess it depends on what kind of an American you are. Certainly, there's a lot of folks here who would eat a lot of goat and enjoy it. But this is a different segment. It's a different culinarily. It's a different sort of thing. And I think that if you put this kind of goat in the hands of high-end chefs, you end up having a really nice dish. And those things trickle down. I think I could think of a lot of trends that started with high-end chefs and, you know, roasted garlic and mashed potatoes, which used to be considered an exotic and fancy food at, white tablecloth restaurants, and now it's, you know, you can't get rid of it. So these trends start at the top and they trickle down, and we think goats will be trickling.
Does goat, even saying it sounds sort of gamey, I mean, does goat meat need a fancy name? You know, sometimes instead of lamb you say mutton, or pigeon isn't pigeon, it's squab.
Maybe that's the next contest you all should have here is how to rename goat. Although I think in this day and age when we want things that are simple and straightforward, you know, the economy's going downhill, I don't think we should mess with goat. I think we should look at, you know, goat with reverence. Goat milk is great. You know, it's considered the universal mother because humans,
goat
all
cheese.
Kinds of animals can drink its milk without reaction. There's goat cheese. There's a little beard thing. There's a lot going
on. You see the little
goat.
Billy goat in like a Disney movie.
It's delicious. It's delicious.
And I encourage people to look. The Disney Billy goat is kind of disturbing.
Or look at the New York Times today and you'll see some lovely pictures of goats and you can just think about how delicious they are. Braised. We have a great braised shoulder recipe in the paper today. So.
Oh, that's all you needed to say is that there are recipes. Folks will be flocking to that website. Kim Severson, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks.
That's Kim Severson reporting about goat meat from the New York Times. And now we have Femi Okeh. He's got the latest headlines for us.
Sorry, I was just looking at the markets, Adora, just seeing how they're doing. Good morning to you all. Coming up to 22 minutes to the top of the hour. Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson spoke this morning on the CBS Early Show about his new plan for the economic crisis. He said his number one priority is to restore confidence in the financial system.
As we stabilize this system and as banks begin to lend and begin to lend to consumers, begin to lend to businesses, businesses resume hiring, we'll make progress here.
Meanwhile, financial troubles will be the main topic at a meeting of 27 EU leaders at a summit today in Brussels. And French President Nicolas Sarkozy will push for acceptance of a plan to help out troubled banks. Most European leaders agreed to go along with that plan earlier this week. And the World Bank will provide $10 billion to 10 countries in Southeast Asia. That's according to an announcement from the president of the Philippines. The funds will help provide liquidity for economies that may have been affected by the global economic crisis. The US presidential candidates will have their last chance to debate in tonight's meeting at Hofstra University on Long Island. The meeting will focus on domestic policy. The Man Booker Prize, one of the most famous prizes in English literature, is going to 33-year-old Aravind Adiga. The Australian Indian author won for his debut novel, The White Tiger. And last night at the awards ceremony, Adiga explained why comedy was central to his book.
One of the things missing in the depiction of the poor in India and other countries is just the sense of humor. You know, the poor are shown very sentimentally as very boring, weak people, and I wanted someone who was aggressive, funny. It was important to capture what I heard when I traveled through India, and humor was an important part of that.
The judges of the Booker Prize described The White Tiger as being in the tradition of Macbeth with a delicious twist, and Aravind Adiga wins over $92,000, and he said that his biggest problem was working out a safe bank to deposit his winnings. We feel your pain.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
We're conducting what we're calling America's Exit Poll, asking you how you've made up your decision or why you haven't made up your decision.
I don't think McCain's the strongest candidate. However, I could never vote for Obama, for somebody who's associated himself all his life with people who hate this country.
There's a thought. We want to hear what yours is at 877-8-MY-TAKE or at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Kathy on our website says she decided on Obama when McCain selected a former beauty queen who said she would take military action against Russia if they infringed on another country. What's your story? 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji. John Hockenberry is away. Three major blazes have burned more than 34 square miles of Southern California, destroying dozens of homes and forcing thousands of people to evacuate this week. One man died in the flames, and a motorist was killed in a crash as a fire neared a freeway. Joining me now is a 35-year firefighting veteran and retired fire captain, Tom Krushke, with Ventura County Fire Department for the latest news on what's happening there. Thank you for joining us, Tom.
Good morning.
So what's the latest on the fires? I understand the Santa Ana winds have died down a bit.
They have died down from what they were earlier in the week, although the threat still remains. Our weather forecasts show we're still supposed to be getting winds through at least this evening and possibly onto the weekend, along with the accompanying low humidities. The favorable thing right now is that the winds aren't as bad as they were earlier in the week, so that's working to our favor at this time.
Where did these fires start, and where have they moved to at this point?
There's been a couple of fires in our area. The Merrick fire started actually kind of on the eastern edge of the San Fernando Valley, around the edge of the Angeles National Forest. The other fire that's more directly impacting us in Ventura County started at the western edge of the San Fernando Valley, right along the LA County-Ventura County line, and has moved into Ventura County yesterday. Hmm. It impacted our community, northeast portion of Simi Valley yesterday.
How many people have been evacuated, do you know?
I don't have exact figures on there. At our end here in Ventura County, we did have some voluntary evacuations and shelter-in-place orders, again, in the northeast portion of the city of Simi Valley and also along the county line. Most of those have been lifted and modified.
And what about homes destroyed? Do you have any sense of what that number looks like at this point?
The last information I had was as far as residential structures, there were 6 damaged and 19 destroyed, and then another 47 outbuildings or other type structures destroyed. To the best of my knowledge, that damage occurred in the L.A. City, L.A. County side of the incident. Here in Ventura County, I have not had any reports of any damage or destruction to structures.
And, Tom, where are you in the season? The Santa Ana winds, they just began rolling through in the last week or two?
In the last week, yeah. This is the time of year here in Southern California when we get our Santa Anas, and it's the real critical portion of our fire season. As the weather patterns change to the east of us, the Santa Ana conditions set up, and through possibly September, but more into October, November, and even possibly into January, we get the Santa Ana conditions, and that is the very tough firefighting and fire danger season for us.
Certainly, it's very dry. It's brutal. I lived in Los Angeles for a long time, and Tom Kruschke, I want to wish you the best.
Thank you very much.
Tom Kruschke is a retired fire captain with the Ventura County Fire Department Public Information Office.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, October 15th. Femi Okay is here because she has the latest headlines of the hour. Femi.
Thanks, Adora. Coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour, we're just looking at the markets between us. What have you got for the Dow?
The Dow's down about 200 points, 2.3%. NASDAQ, down 2%. And S&P so far, down almost 3%.
All right, everything down. And that comes after news that retail sales dropped 1.2% in September, according to the Commerce Department. And that's the biggest decline in 2 years. Wholesale prices also fell for the second straight month. President Bush is meeting with his cabinet today to discuss specifics of distributing $250 billion to 9 major banks. One of those 9, the Bank of New York Mellon, has been hired by the Treasury Department to act as a gatekeeper of the funds, and the bank will keep accounting records and serve as auction manager and sell $3 billion worth of stock to the government. Hurricane Omar is strengthening in the Caribbean Sea. It's moving very slowly northeastward, and a hurricane warning is in effect for the U.S. Virgin Islands. Baylor University in Texas is offering monetary rewards for students who raise their SAT scores, and the school has offered a $1,000 scholarship to admit freshmen retaking the test and raising their score by at least 50 points, and the school wants to raise its national college ranking. And finally, you may not know his name, but I bet you know his work. Have a listen to this.
Of course.
Okay, lots of very strange dancing going on in the studio here. That's the theme music from the Batman TV series composed by Neil Hefti. Now, Neil Hefti sadly died on Saturday, but he will be remembered as a big band trumpeter, arranger and composer. And he worked with Count Basie, and he also composed the memorable themes for the movie The Odd Couple. Neil Hefti, he'll be much missed, died at 85.
Thanks very much, Femi. It brings me back to my childhood. Still with us is Todd Zwillick from the Capital News Connection.
Hello.
And we're going to talk about the economy now, Todd. Something on the minds, as you well know, of most Americans in the midst of the market turmoil and also in the midst of an election year. Seems that nearly every day, each of the presidential candidates is rolling out some new plan on how to fix the economy, and it can be sort of a blizzard of information. And so for some help in teasing out their economic philosophies, that would be John McCain's and Barack Obama's, we turn to Emma Coleman Jordan, a professor of law with a focus on economic justice. She's been paying close attention to the core economic values, as she describes them, that she believes are guiding the presidential hopefuls. Professor Jordan, good morning. Welcome. You refer to something called the economic North Star of the candidate's philosophy. Can you explain that?
Well, I think that the problem for the average voter is figuring out how to take a look at this blizzard of proposals that are coming out, many of them quite detailed, many of them only accessible to experts. And I think in that kind of environment, you've got to identify something that seems solid. And for me, the economic North Star for each of the candidates consists of three things. First, what are their values as they've express them consistently over the years of their careers? Secondly, who are the advisors? What are the cluster of people upon whom the candidates depend for economic advice? And thirdly, they do belong to political parties. What's the track record? What are the preferences, the traditions, and the norms that each of these parties represent? So a president obviously has a lot to do with the direction of the country, but to the extent the president is a member of a party, he will only be nominated by that party if his values are consistent with the party. So it seems to me that in these three areas, values, advisors, and party, you have the opportunity to peel away this heavy layer of often competing, conflicting, and confusing proposals and penetrate a bit deeper.
Let's take a look at your first measurement, core values, and let's apply that to Barack Obama, and then let's apply that to John McCain. Barack Obama, what do you think his core values are based on his proposals and his prior legislative efforts and his actions as a politician?
Well, one of the things we know about him is that he was a community organizer. He's a lawyer, trained as a lawyer, and has served in the state legislature. So those are things that give us some sense of where his priorities lie personally, in that his ability to make money when he first graduated from undergraduate school and then later when he graduated from law school, mm-hmm. he deferred entering the private market to make a lot of money, which he could have and did not. So we can say that his values lie with service. With Senator McCain, you can say the same thing. His values lie with service. He served the country honorably and with distinction in the military. He then went into service again in the Congress and eventually into the Senate. So both of them, on their values, you can say service is a very dominant part of their values. On the economic front, I think that both of them have shown that they are concerned about the state of the overall system of our financial system. But in the case of Senator McCain, he has consistently said that he is a deregulator. He has also indicated that his preference is to let the market work out all solutions to problems, and that is an important value that he has articulated consistently over the years. It's expressed in his votes, it's expressed as well in his public speeches and in his proposals. Mm-hmm. So,
and Barack Obama, by contrast, is more comfortable with the idea of the government intervening.
Yes, I think so. I think it would be fair to say that he certainly does show every indication of having a consistent set of values that he uses the term from the bottom up. He seems to be more focused, very concerned about the people who are in the middle and at the bottom of the economic ladder. And his focus, his lens of values are focused on how are these people doing? What is best for them?
Well, Professor, what is the North Star way of looking at how the candidates handle the economy? You know, candidates talk about the economy in every single election. It's always important. But at this point, everybody's saying we're in a crisis situation. They're not saying it. We are in a crisis. So does the North Star philosophy or the North Star metric apply in a crisis situation?
Well, it certainly does. But I think, as you've properly pointed out, it is very hard to figure out where that North Star is when there's a cloud cover. And that's where we are right now. We are under a cloud cover of emergency circumstances in the economy. And so all of the candidates are moving to a mean that's quite different from where they would be under normal circumstances. So, for instance, certainly we can see that each of the candidates is willing to make use of government power to intervene in the markets in very bold and dramatic ways. We saw that with the bailout legislation, where both of the candidates supported the bailout, supporting a $700 billion plan to acquire what everyone is calling toxic assets, a complex series of financial derivatives from the financial institutions in order to free up their books. Now, that plan was modified later by the Treasury Secretary, but both of the candidates basically supported giving taxpayer dollars to financial institutions through the Treasury Department to rescue the system.
So certainly lots of details, lots of things for voters to consider, but you would suggest they just take a look at their proposals in the context of what they've done before and what some of their core values seem to be. Professor Emma Coleman-Jordan, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Professor Emma Coleman-Jordan teaches economic justice, commercial law at Georgetown University Law Center. She's also the author of Economic Justice, Race, Gender, Identity, and Economics. We're always here on At The Takeaway, and we are conducting America's exit poll.
I'm going to vote for Obama because he's actually talking about changing, finally, U.S. policy towards Cuba. He's talking about family travel now, and I hope he'll open the door for all Americans to be able to visit.
We're looking for snapshots, what voters are thinking about each candidate, why they're choosing one or the other, or why they haven't. You haven't made up your mind. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or drop us a note at mytakeatthetakeaway.org. And if you're looking for a sure bet.
Trends start at the top and they trickle down, and we think goats will be trickling.
That's New York Times food writer Kim Severson with your takeaway, talking about what to watch for on your plate. And I want to thank Todd Zwillick from Capital News Connection, who's been with us this morning from Washington, D.C. You've been here in New York. Thank you.
Thanks. It's been great.
Go, go, Todd Zwillick.
He's got a special theme song. I'm Adoree Doji. This is The Takeaway.
Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.